official welcome, Ed, so we can do, what are you guys talking about?
What are you guys talking about? Yes, we do it live every single time.
Go.
Welcome, everybody, to the show today. We have two very special guests. Ed, would you like to do introductions?
Oh, my God. Like, just I'm buzzing with excitement. A couple of weeks ago, we watched a film and did a show on it called Hosts. And, we both absolutely loved it, heaped loads of praise on it. And then a few days ago, I get a friend request on Facebook from Richard Oakes, Dark Fable Media. And I'm like, I recognize that name. Who is that? And, Richard says, hey, I really thank you for the podcast. If you ever want to have us, come on and talk about it. Adam, co-director, Adam Leader and Richard Oakes, gentlemen, welcome to What Are You Guys Talking About? We are now actually, fulfilling that incredible kind of kismet, it's one of my favorite words. But thanks for joining us, guys.
You're welcome. Welcome. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah. No problem at all. Just to explain, you guys are kind of where we see ourselves in a couple of years, literally. And so that's
when we grow up, we want to
be you. Yeah, that's it. That's it. That's CEO. When
you grow up, you want to be in Rich's office. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, look, genuinely, in terms of your journey with the film, which was our kind of contact point with you guys, and then discovering about your journey and your YouTube channel is just been very inspirational, and it feels very aspirational as well, in a way that some of the films that we talk about Marvel MCU stuff is feels very much like a pipe dream. Whereas one of my favorite things about Hosts was wow, this is a really good film, and I feel like it's a doable thing. It's within my grasp, almost within our grasp.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's open it up to you guys. How did the concept of Hosts come about? So how did when you had your first conceptual days coming up with the script and the story for that, how did that work between the two of you?
Me and Rich, we'd already written a film before Hosts so Rich co-wrote it, I co-wrote it, and Nadia Lamin, who plays Lauren in Hosts, co-wrote with us as well. And it was kind of the film that we were always pushing to try and do, but this particular film requires a fairly big budget. And we kind of realized, maybe a year down the line of trying to go down all these different routes of who can we find that, will give us over £1 million? Just thinking unrealistically, we realized that what we probably need to do is write something low budget in order to get off and do it all ourselves to get our foot in the door. So it was kind of when we made that realization that the story for Hosts sort of stemmed from an experience that I had. I was sitting with my ex-girlfriend, and she said that she could see this blue light by the window in the garden outside, literally how you see in the film. I just saw a blue orb in the bottom left, in real life, the bottom left of the window. So she's all freaked out and whatever. So I went into the kitchen, grabbed a knife because I was kind of scared, and went into the garden and checked it out, and nothing was there. So I came back in and got on the phone to Rich and was like, dude, this could be a cool opening scene idea, or just a cool idea that we could expand off for a film. So we spent the whole night just writing down as crazy as we could go with what scene ideas we wanted to do. And by the end of the night, a very long night, we had sort of a rough storyboard of all these scene ideas and stuff. So yeah, that was kind of it. And then I went away and I wrote the first draft of the screenplay, which me and Rich both went on over the next few months to just keep developing whilst we were, I guess this is all quite condensed, whilst we were funding the film.
Right. Don't worry. We'll get into the nitty gritty of it as we go. We're going to kidnap you guys for over an hour. So it's all good. That's really funny though, because I remember that being the scene that just got me on the edge of my seat. Like, it just the tension that was built from that moment on, and the cinematography in the scene in the garden. Like, yeah, no, Rich, I think I said it on the podcast. I was like, damn, this guy can shoot a scene. God damn.
I think I contacted you. I was like, I need some more of that.
A bit of an ego stroke. Oh, I'm here.
Good DOP is hard to find, Richard. You know that. Yeah, man. You know.
Yeah. And in fact, Richard, you've worked in the industry, you've worked on other films, and I didn't know this, but I'd seen your work at a film festival that I helped organize, the UKIF film festival, the one that was shot in the airplane.
Yes, is that the one with Jake? Yeah, so Jake Francis, and Faith Elizabeth, directed by Patrick Ryder.
In flight, that's it, yeah.
You saw that, what festival was it, sorry?
UKIF. The UK Independent Film Festival. I helped like some people there, like organize stuff, and they showed one of my films in the short film section, and they also showed In Flight. Beautifully shot. Like,
thank you. Well, that was the premiere for that we had in Virgin Media Lounge in London. That's actually set out like an aeroplane. With a screen at the front. So it's quite cool, but. That's actually the first time I ever met Neil Ward was that night. And we chatted outside, and then I was shooting Patrick Ryder's third short the week after that was starring Neil. So we kind of really got to hit it off then. And then a week after that was shot my first feature film, which is 24 Little Hours with Neil. So that's kind of why we kind of cemented that friendship. We kind of gelled and worked together quite a lot in the first few months of meeting each other, and from then on.
And that's kind of from watching your YouTube videos and stuff, it's kind of one of your philosophies is like gather people as you go, work on other people's stuff, and meet people who can help you like fulfill your vision, right?
Totally, yeah. Just look around, work on other projects, and pick up people that you see talent in. Obviously, there's going to be the opposite side of the coin there, but we won't go too into that. And you recognize talent around you and kind of go, I'd love them to work with us. Like Nadia, I picked up, stole her. She was from the first short I did. Second, I've done so many shorts for Patrick Ryder. So the second was actually Chimera, which was Nadia Lamine. And loved her performance in that. So we got chatting, and that's kind of where we kind of invited her to come on to Dirge as a writer, because there's in that film, there's kind of two main protagonist type of people, which is a male and a female. We really wanted the female side of the writing to kind of come from that,
right?
To assume we know the female mind, because it's very much about psychology and stuff like that. We wanted to make sure that the female character was accurately represented, if that makes
sense. Yeah, yeah, no, completely. Yeah. Whenever I write a female character, I'm always like, this is just awful. There's no human being like this on the face of the planet.
Write female characters, me and Rich just put our drag costumes on, and that's it. We don't need ladies anymore.
So what about your background, Adam, in terms of like kind of where you come from in terms of your directing? Richard, you know, is cinematographer, camera kind of guy. How about for you?
I kind of come from the music background, really. I always wanted to make films, and I always wanted to make music when I was a kid and stuff. And I sort of went down the music path first. It just kind of happened. So I started a band, and back in 2014, sort of just by luck, you know, the stars met, whatever you want to call it. Rich was hired to come and shoot our the first music video for the first single from our first album. You know, it was the early days, 7 years ago now, nearly. And yeah, me and Rich met that day, and we thought both of us hated each other. And then it was kind of from that, like from Rich at the time, he had written his, or just about finished writing his first short film, and he put a status out on Facebook saying, "Oh, I'm looking for actors to play the villain in my short film." And I kind of like, I didn't go to stage school or anything. I didn't even go to school. I bunked most of it, but like, you know, I'd never had any experience in the acting world at all. I was just so stuck in the music stuff and touring and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, I just listened to Rich and I said, you know what? I'd love to do some acting. I'd love to play a villain. So
Yeah, the funny thing was, I didn't know any actors at the time because I'd only done music videos. I only knew musicians. So pretty much every actor in my first short film was musicians rather than actors.
So he said, cool, man, like, do you want to audition? So I went off and I did a tape. Rich made me do it in the South.
Do you want to audition? I love that. Do you want to audition? Yeah, I guess so. I guess that's what you're supposed to do, right?
He made me audition in a South African accent. And I had to, terrible on my part. But he gave me the part and then we just hit it off and just became really good friends on the shoot. And then over the next couple of years, he just came along to shows that we played or festivals that we played, and me and him started getting more involved with each other in terms of, that sounds wrong, but in terms of like...
I totally understand. Jason and I have this very, very weird relationship as well.
we just got really close and we're like, man, we want to make films together. And we just had the same mutual interest in wanting to make our own films.
But before that, you kind of joined Dark Fable, didn't you? We worked on music videos together for a while, shooting and working on the concepts and stuff like that together and directing together.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time doing that. I left my old job to come and work with Rich full time. I guess that sort of gave us the confidence that us as a pair work really well together by... Yeah, like Rich said, concepting music videos.
We swear by it just because we are two sides of the same coin, Ed and I. You know what I mean? Like, I'm the crazy amount of energy, run through it. You know, we're both doers in our own right, but Ed's the on-set doer where I'm the one that will go off and promote and stuff like that. And we've both learned more about each other's kind of respective sides of things by working together. But we have to have both because, you know, the thing is, I can get us a deal in the door. You know what I mean? I can get someone so excited to say, yeah, I want to help you with this project. We can get this done. But then, you know, we're going to make commitments to those people saying we can do X, Y, and Z. Ed's the guy to do it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm there to get it done as well, but I've not been doing this for 15 years. I've only been producing for 3 and have been in insurance the rest of my life. You know what I mean? So I totally hear what you're saying, that you can have these partnerships. I mean, we swear by it. And on the podcast, we're always talking about, you know, whether it's producer, director, dynamic relationship, push and pull, but you need to have another brain there to kind of bounce things off of to make sure you're going in, you know, somewhat, I guess, the right direction. And it helps, like you said, it's so apparent on all of your videos and things like that, how well you guys gel together. So
it warms my heart.
Yeah. Makes us smile. Yeah, that is.
I think it's a rare and special thing, and I'm not to put down any of my other friends or anything like that, but there's a certain specialness that I think that is very rare, that you have, that you literally gel, and almost we laugh about it, that we have one brain that kind of, he'll come up with an idea in his head and I'll go, I've got an idea, and I'll go, well, so have I, it's this, and he'll go, well, that's literally what I'm about to say. And that happens way more than coincidence would allow, you know what I mean? And it's, we're so on the same vibe, and there are areas where we do differ. We do actually have quite different tastes in films, which I think ends up creating something quite unique where we kind of,
oh, that's interesting. I want to know more about that, like what are the different tastes?
So I would say I'm more into thrillers and very, maybe kind of down-to-earth, nasty films. I prefer serial killers and stuff like that, whereas Adam's a bit more on the supernatural kind of vibe.
Ooh, okay.
Interesting. That kind of comes across in the film as well so much.
Totally,
that's
yeah.
so funny. And one thing that I wanted to ask, because, you know, this is something genuinely Jason and I have discussed in terms of wanting to co-direct. And, you know, there have been some amazing examples of co-directing at the highest level, at the lowest level, you know, all over the place. And I was just wondering if you could kind of speak a little bit to that and, you know, where you feel you complement each other and things like that. And any advice that you might have for filmmakers who want to co-direct with someone.
Well, I think directing is a lot of tasks. Do you know what I mean? So it's not, a lot of people kind of just see it as the person at the front that talks during the set, during the production. But it starts at like where we're at now with Arnetta, which is pre-production, making sure everything is how you want it, especially if you're writer directors. It starts at the very first inception of an idea, but kind of coming up with ideas and coming up with shots together. And we do that together, like one mind, unified. We'll sit here for 12 hours a day, which we're doing at the moment, working on the next one, kind of just back and forth. How about this? Yeah, I like it, but maybe add this. Yeah, I like that, kind of this. And I think the important thing, going back a little bit, about having that unity that really works, is not being offended by the other person saying, I don't like it. And you both of your goal is to come up with the best thing possible. Whoever's idea that is, it doesn't matter. It's not an ego thing. I think the problem when it goes wrong is when it's an ego thing and it's like, well, that was my idea. And it's like, I can't remember any of whose ideas were what, because we kind of, it's such a process that we're working on, and we don't care whose idea it is or whose idea gets picked. It's as long as it's the best one. And I think that's really important. So kind of taking that through, but then on set, we can't split, well, we can split into two people and take two different sides of the directing. So I'm obviously a DOP in general. So I've taken on kind of being DOP, but also kind of everything visual as far as the set on set. Like we worked on building the set together, but not building, but decorating the props, all that was me and Adam as well. But we did that together. But then on set, kind of moving stuff around, making sure everything's right with the lighting, all that kind of side of things. And then Adam would be outside while we're setting the scene and setting the lights, setting the camera. He was outside talking with the actors, going through them, because he also wrote the script. He knows the intentions of stuff, so he's talking through those types of things at the same time. And then we'd come together, me and Adam would be on the monitor, and we'd watch the scene, and we'd both then come out and go, well, I think this should happen, or this should happen. We'd discuss and then approach the actors and what needs to change and stuff like that. So
it makes sense. I mean, it's exactly the kind of quality control that we keep talking about on the show, because, you know, the ones that don't do as well, I feel like that can be a problem. You know, it's the fact that, because I know how that is about my own writing, you get so tied to something, you're just so in love with it that you don't see it for what it really is. And I, God knows, you know, as a production company, I'm sure you deal with this too. The phone calls we get, that's a lot of what we're trying to sift with them, is saying, like the concepts, you know, I had one where it was like five stories and one, it was like one story. Pick one story, tell me what that story is, and we'll help you make it. You know what I mean? It's just a matter of that. But when you've got two people looking at it, then you at least have that quality control. Then you've got that, you know, second pair of eyes saying, I'm not sure whether that actually works or not, or saying, no, that definitely works, let's make that bigger. You know, and so I think that's a really great thing that the two of you have that. And I know what you mean when you say how rare it is, because I think Ed's the only person I know of out of the people I collaborate with that I can do that with. You know what I mean? That you can just be that open and free with. So, I mean, when it came to coming up with budget for this thing, did you write the script and then break it out and say, okay, this is how much we're going to need? Or did you do it the other way around, where you're like, okay, we're going to have to write the script under the budget that we need? You know, was it a chicken and the egg, or egg and the chicken?
it was a little bit of both. Like, we realized that, you know, who are we to think that we're gonna, you know, be able to do whatever the hell we want? Because you've got to start from the beginning. You've got to be realistic, which is what the whole point of Hosts was. It was to do something within our means in order to open doors for bigger budgets, which is what we're now aiming towards, now that we've achieved it. So we kind of started with, okay, what do we have? Like, how can we make use of what we have? And what we had thanks to Rich's wonderful wife, it was Rich's house. So we had Rich's house to be able to use, and you know, permission from him and his wife to use it, which was great. And we had our composer Benjamin Simons, his house as well, that we used for the first house that you see in the film and stuff. And like, and it was just a case of like, okay, how can we make the best use of what we have? Okay, what about the attic? Let's write an attic scene because we know we can do that. Let's board up the attic. You know, it was all these things that are relatively cheap to do, but you know, make a big impact. Focus on the scene itself as opposed to, yeah, let's have 64 explosions and 12 car chases and, you know, all this crap that doesn't necessarily make a great film. And I'm not saying Hosts is an amazing film at all. You know, there's so many things that if taken from that, we're gonna, you know, mistakes that we've made, that we've learned from, we're gonna not make the same time on the second one. But I think it's down to making use of what you have and being realistic and getting quality over quantity. And that's kind of how we wrote it. And then when we went back through after redrafting, realizing, okay, we can't actually do that. How do we strip this back and do something cheaper but more effective, to the point where we had Craig, our AD, who then priced it up and said, all right, we're gonna need 25 grand, which is what the budget was. I think we raised 23 in the end, and we did it on 23. So yeah, it was kind of that. And then I guess that's when the journey started of, may as well be a million. How the hell are we going to find this money? But we did.
That's absolutely amazing.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit about, you know, one of the most poignant videos that I'm sure everyone just glues to, you know, if there's an indie filmmaker on Dark Fable, they're going to go straight for the one that says, you know, financing, because I just know, like, that's the most. But you guys have a really good response as to how you did that on Hosts. And I just wondered if you could share that a bit with the audience here so they can hear how you finance this, because it was an original method. And I just think, wow, like, that's actually a really clever way to go about it versus kind of the blitzkrieg approach that we all have of going, you know, running out of this fast as you can, not knowing any investors, you know, and just saying, oh, well, we'll ask everybody. So I didn't know if you could spend a little bit of time talking about how you did raise the money and why that was unique, I think, for Hosts.
Yeah, totally. Well, one thing we knew is that we didn't have any money. We did approach a couple of investors, but it was, one, it was our first film, so that's always difficult. There's no proof that we're going to make the money back and not run away and actually deliver a product. And one thing that I've done before with the short film that we talked about, or seen lots of other people do and done, is the kind of the Kickstarter, Indiegogo kind of platform. And I didn't kind of like that. No offense to anyone else who's done that. I think it's fine, but I kind of had an issue, or we kind of had an issue with just kind of, give us 20 quid and we'll give you a rock with a sticker on it.
Or just asking for money, yeah.
And then at the end of it, you get all the you know, the money that the film makes, and the people that got the rock get a rock. Like, even though they're the ones that have paid for your dream, they get nothing out of it. So we were like, at first we started with like a kind of donate. We had a YouTube channel, which obviously you've seen, and we've gotten about 3,000 or 4,000 subscribers at the time, and they were quite loyal and quite vocal and enjoyed the content and stuff like that. So we were like, well, why don't we kind of reach out to them and see if they're interested in kind of helping us by donating at first. We didn't want to kind of offer them kind of cheap crap for it. So it was like, donate a small amount. And then we were like, well, actually, we could do better than this. We could offer them an investment in the film for, like, if they donate over a specific amount, because we didn't want to kind of give investments for 50p, or do you know what I mean? So we were like, where's a good place where it will actually be worth their while kind of investing and getting points for it? Do you know what I mean? Because a 19th of a point is kind of difficult for, like, very small amounts. So we kind of set like a bar around £1,000 or £2,000 bracket for an investment. And then, so as you donate that amount, we'll sign you up the contract and you get points on the back end for the equivalent amount. So like 25 grand, say, was it?
So if someone invested 2,500, they would get 10%, you know, and that's kind of how it is. Or if someone invested,
we're not on the maths.
Yeah, we're not mathematicians. Yeah, or if someone invested, there were some people that invested a couple of grand. There was one person that invested six, one person that invested three, you know, and obviously the more they invest, just the more points we offer them. And that's how we did it. And we felt that that was a good approach to doing it, because they're
I just thought it was so novel. You know, like I said, I have a background in sales and working in the corporate world doing all this. And, you know, you were the first two guys that I heard this from and said, yes, like, because the purpose of your first film isn't to make $1 million. It'd be great, right? But, you know, the purpose of this film, from what you've said on your YouTube channel, and what I completely agree with what you're saying, is so you can come back for the second one and say, like, no, we were successful with the first one. It actually made money, or it broke even, you know, or whatever you can do to say we did something good. You know what I mean? And like I said, it came across my desk because you guys were on Fright Fest before, but then you made number three at iTunes. I was like, we have to watch this now. You know what I mean? Like, what's so hot about this? And that's what I mean. Like, you guys have done, I think, what you set out to do. And what a great way to reward the people that backed you on that. That's exactly the way it should be. The real problem I have with Kickstarter like you is, you know, from a legal perspective, like, you're not obligated to get anybody anything on Kickstarter. Like, I've talked to other, you know, I've produced for other people on that, being like, oh crap, Jay, I told them I'd give them DVDs. And I'm like, you don't have to give them anything. Like, they donated money to you. That's what it is. It's horrible when you do that, because I've seen real fights break out between, you know, fans being like, you owe me this. This is mine. And
I've been burned on some. Yeah, I've been burned on some tech.
I've seen it before in the music world, man. It's the same in the music world. But the same thing happens. Where's my signed album? Don't know. Don't care. It's just
right.
Yeah, and it, I know that, you know, most people don't do that. And, you know, we did a Kickstarter for our second album, actually. And, you know, we delivered. But it's still like, yeah, I mean, like, come on. I mean, how many people out there really, realistically, are gonna cool, here's a signed poster, or here's a lyric sheet, or here's a producer credit on a film?
Right.
It's just, yeah.
Yeah, I'm always very, like, cautious about going to that well too many times, because it is just essentially asking friends and family to give you some money to do your art, you know. If I may, I'd like to kind of do some digging into some of the technical stuff, if it's okay with you guys. Because for me, one of the things that really elevated this film in terms of, like, you know, regardless of what the budget was, you could see a quality on the screen, and a lot of that I felt had to do with the lighting and the visual style and stuff like that. And there was one scene that, don't ask me why, but I just kept rewinding and watching again and again and again, because it was just lit so beautifully. And I just wanted to ask Richard, if you wouldn't mind just talking a little bit about the you know, how you lit the scene. I'm talking about the one where Michael is in the kind of garage basement and he's talking about the TV. Mm. And you have just a beautiful frame. And I was wondering if you could just kind of talk a little bit about, you know, what lights you might have used or your approach to it.
Hopefully, I hope.
I'm trying to remember.
I hope we're not asking that question at Comic-Con where we just stood up with the paper like, sir, in episode 43, you did this. But we really did appreciate it. Like, literally, it blew our minds, the quality of the shooting. So
that was the one that was a little bit more ad-libbed on the lighting side. So I'm trying to remember exactly the setup, and I may get it wrong, because most of the other rooms were a bit simple. I think that was one of the most... The lounge was the dinner scene was the most complicated, but I do remember how that was set up. Mm. the garage one, the first thing we had was an aperture 120D out the window, which is shining daylight in to kind of get the beams. We had a hazer in there to get the shafts that kind of came from behind him when he's talking, and backlight, air light.
Yeah.
I think we had a main just practical tungsten bulb in the garage, and then up in the rafters to his left was another 120D with a tungsten gel, just giving him a side light kind of there, but it was very kind of minimal because he's very silhouetted.
Yes, very in darkness, which is what I absolutely loved about it.
Yeah, I like darkness. I do things slightly different to other DOPs that I've seen, which I've seen DOPs kind of turn up with truckloads of lights and then set them all up, and then they're getting out all their flags and flagging them all off, and I'm like, well, just
lights.
Like I think pretty much every scene but the dinner scene was three lights max. So
right, and that's that kind of indie thing, right? It's like working with less, and that's how you bring budgets down. Could you also talk about that dinner scene, because you know Jason and I both rapped about it and just absolutely loved it.
As in writing wise,
the concept of the dinner scene, and whether you took any inspiration for any of it, or
Tarantino was a really big inspiration on that scene. Revealing the threat very early on, and dragging it out. Some say it's too long. Some say it isn't. I guess that's all that matters, really. But yeah, that was a big inspiration in terms of the dialogue and how it's drawn out and stuff, and revealing that threat early on. Rich says this better than me, but there's the whole, would you rather just have a quick shock that you weren't expecting, that is just a moment of, or would you rather reveal the threat and have this tension building and building?
Yes.
Knowing something's going to happen, but not quite knowing what it is or how severe it's going to be. And I think that leaves a long lasting effect on the person watching it, or many people watching it. And you walk away from that remembering it and feeling what the characters around this horrific trauma, whatever's going on, are experiencing. You're experiencing that trauma with them. And I think it's because you sort of know that something bad's going to happen, but you don't know to what extent it is. And I think
that's a great, amazing.
I mean, that was the extent of, we talked about that in the podcast. That was kind of the extent of your promotion. Because I mean, I heard about the film because of that scene. I'm sure almost everybody
on the Fright Fest crew did.
It was like, have you seen that death scene? They won an award for it. It was like, no, I haven't seen it. Is it that bad? And they're like, mate, you have to see this.
Yes!
Exactly. Like, the really best thing is, it just gets people to come. But what I really loved about how you set that up is you made me wait for it. And it was like, it was, as a horror junkie that I am, I knew it was coming. The minute it started getting really cutesy, I was like, uh-oh, like they're going to rip the rug for me at some point. But just like a good roller coaster, you want to get to the top.
Yes.
You know what I mean? You want to go on the ride. You wouldn't get on the roller coaster. So, I even had to warn Ed, because he's not the biggest horror guy. And I said, like,
I don't like gore.
Really messy. So, if it's too much for you, just let me know, buddy, and you can talk about it on the podcast. But for me, like, I've been setting up for this kind of stuff my whole life. I'm like, yes, let's do it. And then it happens. And like, it happens almost quickly. And I was like, wait, did that just happen? And like you said, the best part about it was immediately the aftermath is then taking stock of everyone who's there that you just missed for a second. And you're like, oh my God, now what's playing out around me? Like, as I said, setup and delivery on that was perfect. It, horror type. You've got to set them up to knock them down, I guess. And yeah, I was really impressed. Really impressed.
Oh, thank you so much, man. Thank you.
Was there any internal discussion over, from a producer's angle, was there any internal discussion about the severity of that and like how you were going to portray that on screen? Because obviously it is so graphic in the end there. Was there any discussion about that, or was it always like, this is how we're going to do it?
I think there was a discussion just from the producer, just because I think they felt that discussion needed to be had, but they were with us the whole way. They just said, is this a good idea? Because, it could get us, less popularity because of how severe it is. And we basically said, well, it's kind of a selling point of the film. He said, I completely agree. I just thought I'd raise that. So that was as far as it went. I think everyone was on board, and I think everyone still is on board, because I think that is the reason why most people jump on this film. Like, as frustrating as it is to have a one trick pony kind of thing. Do you know what
I mean? That's like a home run. Like that's what that is. And just in terms of the technical aspects of shooting that, did you go out and get like a prosthetics person, or like how did you kind of go about it?
We hired an absolute genius special effects prop maker lady called Kate Griffiths. I don't know if you guys have crossed paths with her before.
Sounds familiar. I think she might have worked with Katie Bonham before, and I used to work with Katie on a bunch of stuff. So sounds like she does a lot of props and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, she's awesome, man. Like, couldn't recommend her more. But yeah, we brought her on board, and we gave her the script and told her this is kind of what we want, and just worked really closely with her and stuff, and she brought that vision to life. You know, I think we thought she was just going to bring a head that she'd just made, but then she turned up with like a mesh frame in the shape of the body with that we put like a, you know, we bought the same costume 3 times for each actor. We put the costume on that and shaped it and stuff, and it was just brilliant. It was just great. So yeah, it was kind of like half a dummy, you know, half a person in the form of a dummy, the head being the main prop.
That was kind of a bit of a lifesaver, especially time-wise, because we were running very behind that day due to some indie rookie mistakes of Murray on some of the costumes, and the first night with some of the costumes and Nadia's dress, we got the camera rolling and on, and we put the 100mm on, looked on, and we're like, there's Murray all over her dress. And
oh, crap.
Her dress for the whole film, like, what do we do? So we had to run to the shop, find something that worked with the color palette of the film, found the iconic kind of orange dress that she wore, and brought it back, and they're like, that's brilliant. So that kind of put us behind. But then when Kate brought in the whole body, we'd never not seen it till then. Like, we saw little bits of it, like the jaw that you see at the end for a split second. We'd seen that, and it was like, that looks great. Kind of trusted it. But we thought it was a head, and I thought we'd have to do a plate with Jennifer, the actress, lying on the table, and then put the head there and hit the head and then kind of comp it together. We thought we'd have to do a lot of that. But when she brought in the whole torso, we were like, well, brilliant. That saves us so much time. One in plates and two in the visual effects afterwards. So, it was brilliant.
That's amazing. And so you literally just said to her, look, we're going to shoot this head, and we want to be able to smash it with a hammer and for blood to explode out of it. That was kind of your primer to her.
Kind of, yeah. She said, well, how much do you want? Do you want like a hole in the top? Because she kind of did it in like 3 stages. We had like the full head that gets a couple of hits, and then she'd replace that with slightly worse one, and then the final one.
Interesting.
She was kind of designing the final one. She was like, so how do you want it? Like a hole in the top? And I was like, it's flat. And she was like, so like kind of like crushed it. And I was just like, flat. Okay. Like, what do you mean? I was like, it needs to be as flat as it possibly can. Right. Just, that's just kind of this idea that couldn't leave my brain, was just how flat I wanted it. Just so almost ridiculous, like nothing left.
Right. And you do some visual effects and stuff like that as well, right? Like the opening, for example. Was there any additional stuff done to the head scene in like the computer, or was it all practical?
Ever so slightly. There was added blood splatters to certain bits, especially the first hit. She did fill it with blood, but it didn't kind of squirt out as much as we wanted to. So we added some of that. I think the initial hit as well, I compressed in post a bit more, so you see this real crunch on the initial hit. Other than that, I think that was all pretty much in camera. I think that's awesome. Reshaped her back ever so slightly because of the mesh that formed a slight bulge that looks like unnatural, so kind of softened that off a little bit. Just little things. It's ridiculous. I think there's like something like 150 visual effects shots in the film, but 90% of them are just removing stuff that shouldn't
be. Hiding stuff. Yeah.
That's great, though. I mean, that really was, again, when we were talking to our viewers, who were, a lot of them listened for the indie filmmaking stuff, but some of them are aspiring filmmakers as well. You know, the ideas we were trying to show how the quality really helped you guys on this one, because, you know, the horror community is just so flooded, I would say, when it comes to ideas. You have to do things to stand out. So you had that gore scene, obviously, that does it. But also, you know, it's always, you know, you hear first time filmmaker and it's like you already get ready to like let half the movie go and be like, it's okay. Like, it's your first try. Like so many, especially if you do the Fright Fest thing where you go year after year after year and see them. And like with your film, that was the really cool thing, because I wouldn't have known it was your first film. It looked so so tight that
really
way.
Polished, yeah.
Polished throughout the way through. I guess the other thing I had questions about as far as polish, your sound design was amazing on that film because of the ups and the downs. Who worked on that, or was that both of you kind of working through that?
What do you mean by the sound design?
Like usually, you know, sometimes like I like the choice of music always, as I said, love the metal and love other things like that. But also like what I find that a lot of first time filmmakers aren't catching in their films are these kind of the idea of putting the background stuff in and making
the sure ambient stuff.
So when I apologize because I don't know if cutesy sounds offensive, but when you had your cutesy scenes, right, your music uplifts for that. You know what I mean? You have the relevant stuff in there to say, hey, you know what I mean? Like, we're in a happy moment now. And that's why if you listen to the podcast I talked to before, it reminded me a lot of some of the stuff you see from like Hollyoaks or EastEnders or stuff where they're trying to get you into that warm comfort zone saying like, this is a good moment. But then you also had, like Ed pointed out to me, that eerie, the fairy one. What was it? The sugar plum
fairy. The sugar plum fairy, dissonant sugar plum fairies.
Well, it's actually renamed on the score. If you go to the score on Spotify, which you can listen to it all, it's called the Skullcracker Suite instead of the Nutcracker Suite. So
nice. that was a really good choice.
Yeah, well, that was a discussion that we had quite early on with Ben, the composer, who's an absolute genius. Absolutely love his work, especially on posts. we kind of experimented with different things. We wanted the Christmas theme and that, but that was kind of, I can't remember whose idea that was, but again, it doesn't really matter whether it was his side or our side with the Sugar Plum Fairy, but just the idea to make it super dissonant. And then he added his own score kind of to the standard of it. And I think you ran it through like a vinyl replicator. So you had that wobble to it and the crackle and all that kind of stuff. And then kind of started to dissonate the notes. And it was just, when we first heard that, we were giggling.
Oh, man. Special, yeah.
So, and how were the songs chosen? So the opening and the closing, and I can't remember the band name off the top of my hand, though. Both decent songs, though. That's your band?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Hey, that's awesome, dude. Also,
I was about to ask you how you save costs on that. Well, that makes sense.
good bit of acting as well as the boyfriend. Well done.
How high were you when you watched it, man?
It's not a good thing to ask in that one.
Also, if you look very carefully, he's actually the last thing you see on the TV before they leave the lounge. There's him advertising a handbag.
In a wig. In a wig.
Which is an advert from our channel, kind of a comedy for a handbag with an extraordinarily long handle. and so we decided to put that trailer on the TV just to tickle ourselves.
I love that. I love that. That's amazing. Is it okay to talk a little bit about YouTube?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, because you know, you guys obviously you built up an audience with YouTube, which helped kind of fund the film and the like. How do you feel about YouTube as a platform? I know that it's a bit up and down, right?
for new content creators, I think it's sort of a bit dead in the water. Or I guess we sort of feel that now, which is why we're taking a step back from being so consistent with it like we used to be.
Right.
We started the channel, we were having fun, it was building, we were building this fan base, and then we had the idea, maybe we can approach these guys and see if they can help fund the film and invest in the film and stuff. But it seems to just, you know, we took some time off for the whole post-production part of hosts and everything, and getting it back up and running is like, it's almost impossible. You know, I think it's extremely hard nowadays to make a decent living, even if you're just one person and you're not a pair like us. You know, to make a living from YouTube, it's very difficult. And you might, I think it's almost like a lottery ticket. You have to be in it to win it. But also at the same time, if you're not really hitting stuff that is or could be relevant anytime soon, you're not going to get anywhere. And if one of your videos does go viral and does go do really well, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get thousands and thousands of people subscribing and watching every other video, which is also what we found. You know, there are a couple of videos that have done seriously well on the Dark Fable channel, but they don't really encourage many new subscribers, you know, and also you need millions of hits to make, I guess, the money that comes, the revenue that you generate from it, to be worthwhile to actually keep doing this, because it is essentially a full-time job if you want to do it. So, yeah.
No, I'm with you. I mean, these are the kind of things Ed and I in our studio, because I you know, on the side, I have a 10 to 12 hour day job, you know what I mean? So I'm always crunched for time, just always crunched for time. And I would agree with you with what you're saying on YouTube, because we have a Dungeons and Dragons channel that we love. That we run. We run that for passion. You know what I mean? We're just big D&D players. We've always enjoyed it. Something that we started.
Big old nerds.
But, you know, I try to get the business end of it done and start saying, okay, where can we start making revenue off assets and things like that? And, man, the YouTube scene is difficult that way, because, A, you have to have a minimum number of subscribers that you have to get up to at a certain point. And, you know, especially in COVID right now, you're competing with, and I hate to say competing, because, you know, Ed and I have been talking about this past couple of weeks, like, you know, because everybody's got a podcast now and everybody's got a YouTube channel and everything like this. And the worst thing is then you start looking at everybody else wondering what they're doing. And I hate that. I'm like, I don't really care what anybody else is doing. What are we working on? You know what I mean? That's what we need to focus on at all times, because you can get completely distracted by just following the Facebook feed of what everybody else is doing. So no, I definitely hear you, man. It's one of those things that's tricky, because how much time do you spend? You know what I mean? As indie producers, indie filmmakers, we don't have, you know, you've got day jobs too, some of it in the industry, which is great, but do you know what I mean? We have to make a living somehow and do this. And so I hear you that YouTube for me just ends up being one of those, well, if we spent 20 hours a week on it, we might get some results, but I'm not sure the money we're going to make is going to be worth not too much
spending it somehow. Yeah. The one thing that I will say for it, at least for me, I don't know if you guys experienced this, but I found it hard to kind of fill the time between projects, whether it was my own or ones that I was working with other people. And I felt a little bit like my skills were getting a bit like wonky. And so one of the things that I've liked is the fact that, you know, I have to get my lenses out, I have to clean them, I have to, you know, get transfer the footage, edit it, you know, do the pitiful color grading that I do, just, you know, go all those steps, and it keeps me doing it consistently. And in that sense, I did find it, and I have found it very, very useful. But it is interesting. Just as a business model, you're probably right. Its day is probably gone.
Yeah, it's very hard. I mean, at its peak, I think we were doing 4 days a week for £30 a month, and that's a hard job.
Yeah.
To split between us, you know,
like 15 quid each. Yeah.
It's when you look at it, you're like, and it was hard work. It was grueling.
Yeah, because I will say though, you guys have a kind of standard of quality which is not necessarily the most common. to a certain degree. Like honestly, like I one of the things about me doing like a weekly thing, and at the beginning obviously I needed Jason to kind of help me, you know, get rolling, but it was easy that it would just be me set up my camera, hit record, edit for a couple of hours, and then boom, out, you know. I can't imagine how much. I love the TARD reels at the end of the episodes though. Like, just because it makes me laugh so much, because, like, you know, Jason and I have been talking about presenting as well, and do we write a script, do we memorize a script, do we, you know, I tend to do just more flowing whenever I'm presenting on YouTube. But oh god, I just pissed myself when you said, oh, and it's a hit, and then you punched Adam in the face.
Twice that's happened. There's an old where he does that as well. Slightly harder, I think, the first time.
Yeah, I remember, like, you were like, just hit me, man. I'm like, sure? He's like, yeah.
But I will say, again, obviously, like the YouTube thing, you know, it is tough and it's a lot of work. But what I appreciated a lot about it in watching the videos is that I got to know you guys as well. And beyond just like, oh, it's a film production and they've done this film. Like, it's like I felt like I got to know you guys. And it's one of the reasons why I love doing this podcast.
Yeah, Jason, we can resonate with that. I mean, we don't obviously we don't make any money from the podcast whatsoever. Now, some weeks we have listeners, some weeks we don't. Most weeks we do. But it's one of those things for me, like when I'm out pitching for the company, it's like, well, listen to this episode or listen to that episode, because we talk to our friends in the industry on the episode. We talk about what we want to make. And we talk about basically everything that we're doing there. So if you really need to know what I'm like, what I'll be like on set for you, like, this is an easy way for you to see, you know, just how enthusiastic we are about what we do. And that's why I love Dark Fable. Because when I went there, I was like, yes, like, you are making a statement and saying, these are the type of directors we are. Like, this is what we do. And I just think more people should be doing it. The other guy I know that does that, one of my mentors, Lloyd Brewster, has always been big on making sure he gets content out. He puts out more than I do, for Christ's sake, you know, and it's always a bit, you know, I'm always like, Laura, you sure you need to do that much? He's like, I have to, I've got it all funded. Like, okay. But at the end of the day, like, you have to, I think, as an independent producer, you know, at least be showing people who you are, because otherwise, who knows you? You know what I mean? If there's so many people out there trying to get their films made, I think if you don't put a face to it, the thing I loved about your stuff as well is you didn't use the usual jiggery pokery. Like, you know, you actually talked about finance. You don't know how many YouTube videos are out there, maybe you do, that are like, I'll show you how to get finance, and then just talk nothing for longer than you. Usually it's like 20 minutes of them saying like, well, you can check out this book, or you can check out this, or you can check out that. Like, you literally were reciting from like a book that I bought ages ago to teach me about writing business plans for films. Like, the kind of stuff people need to hear, as opposed to the mystery and the smoke and the mirrors, you know, that exist out there. So, no, I mean, there was a real, as Ed said earlier, kismet with that. We just thought, like, that's awesome. You know, they need to see that going. And, you know, we understand what you're saying about trying to keep it going, but it's cool that it's out there for you guys as well.
Totally. And we're like, I completely get everything that you're saying. I think we think it's very important for, because it's hard for directors and for people to go, oh, you know, oh, we want to use them or we want to fund them. It helps to build yourself as a brand. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
So to have that kind of brand and have that YouTube channel really helps kind of build us as a brand, even though they're complete idiots and stuff like that. And we have had those discussions, you know, when we're on the channel, we're like, well, the way we funded was kind of, it worked, but it's really kind of amateur in a way that we're not doing it the way that Hollywood does. But, you know, let's just be honest. This is the way we did it. We could pretend that we went and spoke to some millionaire in the Ritz and, you know, sweet talk them and all that kind of thing, but that's not what happened. So we've always kind of been quite real with that and been honest with how we did things and what things went wrong or things we failed at, or I think that's important. I think that's what gives people kind of trust in you, if you're not kind of just this guy who's like, well, I went to America with a dollar and now I'm a millionaire.
Right.
Rather than those stories, I a lot of that comes over from you know, 10 years at my other job being a lawyer and working my way up that way. Like, you know, we had the same problems in that industry, that you get told fantasy tales about the guy who makes CEO in 3 years because that's what he did. And I've mentored many people in that career, and it's like, you just have to get the fantasy out of the way, because it's not the end of the world. Like, I don't, you know, for me, having worked in the corporate world for a decade, like, the film world's awesome to me. I'm always like, God, if I could make as much money doing this as I do in the corporate world, which isn't a ton, you know, I'd be like, well, I'd easily switch over. But I guess the point I'm making is, like, I think you can do it just for that passion. Now, you know, I said it in the last podcast we were talking about, you know, I don't think anyone gets into any filmmaking saying, I want to be a millionaire, or I want to be rich, you know, off that. And if you are, I think you really need to consider not being an indie filmmaker, because Jesus, like, none of the stories that I ever hear, none of the people I talk to, and I talk to a lot of people, right? Like, ever talk that story. But on the same side of the coin, like you said, you know, it's about doing. Like, the cool thing is, you have the tools. Like, you know, I love the video you did on the Black Magic. We have a Black Magic. No, it's only 1080, unfortunately, it's not 4K. But, you know, I have a Panasonic G80. Like, what can we do with that is more better than sitting around 10 days and saying, what money can we get together? You know, like mm-hmm. I'd rather be outside filming something and then thinking how I'm going to take care of it in post, rather than spending 2 weeks worrying about where money's going to come from when I can just be out there doing it. So, and I just think you guys get that across so well on your website. So thank you for that.
Yes. Well, just kind of going back to the film a little bit. One of the real kind of success stories, I guess you would say about this film is how you managed to get it distributed and kind of how that came about, particularly with the crazy circumstances that just happened, you know, when you had your film in the can.
Well, that's a tight set. All right, okay. Here's the story.
Okay, now it begins. Now the podcast begins.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I really do want to hear the story.
So, Rich had just finished the edit for the film. Just finished, in the bag, ready to go. Then COVID happened, which was kind of, in a way, a blessing in disguise for this.
Right, but I imagine at the time, not so much.
Well, at the time, it was sort of like, okay, well, I don't know. It didn't seem
at
the time.
It killed our plan
like,
to go to Cannes. That was the only thing, really.
It killed the plan to go to places like Cannes and stuff and you know, it saved us money in the end, but it killed our plan to go to these places and be like, right
and shop it around. And
yeah, let's shop it around. Let's do the thing and you know, the thing that everyone finds awkward. Let's go up to someone and try and network and speak to a distributor and kiss their ass, essentially.
The traditional indie film routes, right?
Yeah, sure. And so in the end, we actually just sat there. Like, I was at my girlfriend's and it was locked down, and Rich was here and it was locked down, and we were like, okay, let's just find every single distributor on the face of the planet, write down their emails, and if we haven't got their emails, let's find, because we were given a list of a fair few in there, some high, some mid, some low, but there were also some higher level ones that we didn't have, but we wanted to reach out to them, because why not start at the top, right? So we went online and we were, for example, Lionsgate, let's say, we'd find like a website you'd have to pay for to get the full email address, but it would say, for example, if it was richardoakes@lionsgate.com, it would be like r**, whatever. So you'd have to, so we would find the names of
Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, we would have to find the names of the people. So if Richard Oakes is the head of acquisitions at Lionsgate, we'd go, right, how many different combinations of this name and this email can we do? And we keep sending the template email that we had, which was, hi, we're yada, yada, yada. Here's the trailer for our film. We're looking for worldwide distribution. Would you like a private screener? And we would keep sending it to the emails we were guessing until it stopped bouncing back. And it's sent, right? And all of a sudden...
Oh, my God.
Yeah, literally, this is how we did it. And we did it in one night, and we'd sent 174 emails in the space of a night. All of a sudden, the next day, we had people from all over the world, like high all the way down to low level distributors, saying, hey, yeah, we really like the trailer. Can you send us a private screener? So we sent them the private screener, and all of a sudden, we just start getting offers in, or people wanting to get on the phone with us, and we're... So like the following week, we were chatting to America, Canada, Australia, Spain, Italy, like all these different people from these different countries. But we had our eye on Dark Sky Films, who eventually picked it up for American distribution rights. And that's kind of how it happened. We sent it to them, and we really wanted them, and yeah, they loved the film, and yeah,
we kind of knew that's where we kind of sat. It was nice to kind of take a punt for like the Lionsgates and the Foxes and stuff like that, who actually did get back to us and actually asked for a screener, watched it, and gave us feedback, which was
wow.
And we actually got
just because that gets your name out, right? Like
totally. I mean, we got an email back from the head of acquisition in LA from Lionsgate and saying, "Can we jump on a conference call, please?" At like 4 o'clock this afternoon, and we're just like dying,
slogged out,
running around the garden going, what the hell could this be? We must be getting sued because they've seen something in the film that they think is in a film that they've got coming out, and we're in trouble. That's the only reason they'll want to talk to us. So I'm like, this is the scariest I've ever been in my life. And you're like, it's not that rich. And I'm like, what else could it be? I'll film it. So we get on the call with them and they're like, we just want to say how much we love the film and that we really respect you guys as new directors and stuff. They said, just to let you know, it's a bit too small for us, but we've got our eye on you. And we're just like, holy hell, like
jaw drops.
That's amazing that they said that. Like, obviously it would have been awesome if they were like, how much do you want? But
if wishing were, yeah.
But it was really nice to hear that. It's great that we kind of have that email with them and that background now that they're kind of wanting to see what we do next and stuff like that. But so we kind of knew like we kind of where our film kind of sat, even though we punted for these really ridiculously high ones. So we knew Dark Sky were a great distribution company that we liked. So we kind of picked to them and they sent that like...
Oh man, it was like a huge, huge essay of why they loved the film, how much they enjoyed it, the reasons why, their favorite scenes, their favorite characters. They were so passionate about it that we were like, let's go with these guys. But they're just
holy shit, yeah.
Yeah, they're just as hungry to get this film out there. And yeah, we it didn't take long, but we negotiated for maybe a few days and stuff, and it was very easy. Like that was it.
Hidden in your answers there, you guys always, both of you make it sound so easy because you're just hard workers.
Yeah.
That's the hard work. You sent out the emails, you did the research on who, you know, it's one of the things that was apparent from the film itself, you know, from script all the way to seeing it. You guys understood the film that you had, you know, you knew what you were trying to make, you delivered on that. And then looking at, you know, Dark, you know, it's just that kind of follow through. That's the type of stuff our listeners would be really, really happy to hear. Cause that's the confusing stuff. People think, well, how do I know all the distributors? Like it's not confusing, but it requires work. You have to research who they are. You have to research what they want. You know, and I guess the next question I would ask you is when you're doing that research, if you guys could help our listeners out, what kind of stuff places do you guys look for that kind of information? Was it Google searches, talking to contacts? You know, what's the best way that you get that information about the different distributors?
Any way you can get it.
Yeah, just any which way but loose. So yeah.
Completely. It's like we had friends that had contacts for us. I think it was actually through Neil that we got Dark Sky, not through the email thing, but we, you know, I'm not recommending it, but make up the emails, go on the you know, the Lionsgate, and it says info@lionsgate.com, whatever, change the info to the head of acquisition's name and try some variants of that. That's what we did. And we did that with Signature, actually, and they kind of got back to us and were like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's
this. We did exactly that with Signature Entertainment to the point where they did make us an offer. We didn't end up going with them in the end, but it just goes to show that if you have, and Rich said it before, or maybe not today, but this is what he kind of says, and we live by this ethos, like, have the audacity to do it. Like, don't give a shit about how others do it or how others don't do it. Just do it, man. Like, and just whatever you can. Like, and I think that is also the hardest part. It's not getting demotivated or disheartened if, you know, you're all the way down here and like, okay, well, I've just made a film, or maybe I haven't made my first film yet. And like, how do I climb this huge mountain? You start. That's it. You keep going. You just keep going.
Adam, you need to have a second career as a motivation speaker.
He's too busy motivating my fat ass.
That's literally Jason with me. That's literally the same with us.
Happens. No, I mean, it reminds me of, I remember watching at the Fright Fest over the summer, they had the Clapboard Jungle, which I just love that film because it makes indie filmmaking just seem so depressing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
But it's documentary.
That's what it's like, you know, like you have to wait for the project to take off and then it's hurry up and wait, but you can always be doing. And so that's why I just like the end message there. It's like, I feel bad for people to get discouraged because there's a lot of worse things you could be doing You know what I mean? I guess that's how I always put it because I've seen it. You know what I mean? Like, trust me, there's a lot more shit jobs out there than being an independent filmmaker. So if you really love it, then do it. You know what I mean?
For sure, man. It's a hard climb, and it certainly doesn't. It doesn't all get given to you after you achieve the first hurdle. The first hurdle for us, yes, we've achieved, that's host. But now we're like, okay, we've got something to show, so that we can now push to get a significantly higher budget for our next film that we're writing. We haven't even thought, well, we have thought about how we're going to try and go about getting the budget that we want for it. But first it's like, well, let's spend the time we need to writing this next film and making sure that every beat hits where we want it to and that the story is solid. And then when we're confident in that, that gives us the confidence, and it's finished, that gives us the confidence to then go and speak to whoever we can and hustle with whoever we can to get in front of investors, you know. And if you don't, if you've got something that you believe in, and if you can bring yourself down to earth as well and be honest with yourself and say, is this sellable? Is this good? If it's not, go back to the drawing board. But if you do have something that's good and you put the time into it, then you will get, just talking on an investment level at the moment, you will get the money. You will get it, but it's having the audacity to just do it and not be afraid.
On that point, well, of being honest with yourself, be open to criticism, because criticism sounds scary and it's horrible to receive, but it's also your best friend. And we have a pool of people now that we don't necessarily work with, but we respect on a level that they're professionals in script writing, story consulting, all these things. And we send them the scripts that we do and go, is this any good? And, you know, at first, when you first start, everyone has that thing of thinking they're the greatest thing since sliced bread and their ideas are so original and so amazing. But you come back to earth pretty quick because, you know, this happens and you learn to become a bit more humble. And we've gone through it all and been humbled and humbled and humbled until we were kind of like, we've got so much wrong in the past, so much. We did that so wrong. We hold our hands up. We wanted to do our own thing, and maybe that's not exactly the way it should go. We should listen to these professionals that have said, your story needs to have this point and this point and this point. We're like, yeah, we're cool. We're like auteurs. We're great. Like, and it's like, and then we're getting reviews back and Netflix going, oh, that's not quite right. And we're like, oh, maybe we should have listened to some of those people. So yeah, you do eat a bit of humble pie sometimes. So it's good to have, and this is what I tell every writer or director I work with now, send the script to someone you really respect their opinion of, that's a professional, knows what they're talking about, and then listen. Do you know what I mean? It's not a dig, it's not a personal attack on you if they don't like certain things or things aren't working. But you don't have to change everything that they say, but just be honest.
Try and take it on board.
Take it on board and be honest with yourself and go, maybe give it to someone else. If they come back with the same feedback, and then you go, oh, maybe there's a problem here. Let me see if there's another way to do it. Even with our latest script, there was something that was like, this is Adam was like, there's something feeling not right about this. And I was like, yeah, but I don't want to lose that. I love that. That's probably my favorite bit that we've written. He was like, not sure it's working. And I'm like, it's got to stay. We can fix around it until it works. And he was like, I don't know. And then we spoke to a friend of ours, scriptwriter, consultant, and he was like, not sure this is working. And I'm like, but there must be a way you can help me fix it. He was like, it would kind of be better if you lost it. And it was like, but I love it. And he was like, try a version without it. We can put it back in afterwards, but it might help see where, and I knew what he was doing. And so we went away and wrote a version without it. We were like, this is much better. And it's like, just let go, like let go of your darlings and let go.
No, again, like one of our top messages that we give out here, because it is interesting. And I'm someone that suffered from this for years before I actually jumped into filmmaking, but you will have all the ideas in the world and then not understand that those ideas don't go anywhere by yourself. And so, you know, filmmaking is great that way. I think it's a great equalizer. You could be the greatest writer, director on the planet, but you need a team to make that film. So if no one's had a look at it, it's never going to get made. And like you said, often early on, those are the people we run into, is the I'm working by myself. I have this idea. I want to make this. And it's like, well, it's great. Let's let that idea flourish for some other people and see what everybody thinks. And then people get precious about it. And it's like, well,
very protective. Yeah.
The film will never get made if it's not made for everyone to see. And that's often, you know, we've had that on actual gigs that we've done where we just couldn't get to that person and say, sorry, like, this is your vision, not the vision we would see everyone else having for this. But it happens. And I think the best way, like you said, is just get out there and talk to people. You know, one of the things we did post-December, because we were in a bit of a slump, I had all these, you know, you can watch the trailer we did in Halloween. Like, we have four short films that are ready to go, basically, ready to get shot. But I've not got any crews or anything. And that's because in COVID, I'm not going anywhere. So I said, Ed, we got to get on the Zoom call. And I said, you know, we just started emailing people and saying, can you please come on for an hour? Can we talk to you about this? And it's a lot of times we're just talking, like, we're not going to be doing anything with them specifically now, but it's that connection. It's that having that network of people. And Ed kind of taught me that, because, you know, Ed used to, it's a story I often make you tell on the podcast, but he was kind of like a hippie film commune, you know, back when he lived in Korea, back before, this was after I left and came back to England, and he stayed there. And yeah, why don't you tell him a little bit about it, man? It always sounds so cool.
Yeah, no, it was just a very cool kind of very community oriented group of people who had, you know, obviously done arts degrees and then couldn't find a job. So they went out and taught English in South Korea. but it meant that there was, you know, plentiful actors, composers, cinematographers, and we created this kind of little, you know, enclave. And it's funny because some of your shorts on your YouTube videos really remind me of, we used to do this thing called Cat in a Box, where we would all get together at someone's apartment at like 5 a.m. on a Sunday. And whoever showed up with whatever gear they showed up, we would then write a short and film and edit it all in that like one day. So it was like a 48-hour film festival on steroids,
yeah,
and completely self-inflicted. You know, but it created this great kind of sense of community. And again, you know, in the film world in general, it's such a kind of teamwork thing that, you know, from your composer to your actors to your producers and, you know, your co-director, it's a beautiful kind of harmonious thing. Or that's how I like to think about it, you know.
Yeah, totally. That's like we used to do, like you said on the channel, we used to do basically a short film every weekend, and we were together for 3 days, 2 days a week, and we had to write an episode of dialogue that was in kind of interesting and had information that people might want to know, plus write, shoot, edit, grade, do the music for a short film every single week. And you can tell why it burnt us out doing
it. I do, but I'm telling you, man, like, and I know, you know, your work on your music videos in terms of your cinematography and stuff like that, and, you know, the other shorts you've done, like, I'm sure that was massively influential in honing your craft. But I think that the YouTube channel has to have had, like, an influence and kept you sharp and stuff like that.
It was definitely interesting, I think. It was never done to the level that you would do professionally, because you're just like, let's get this done. Like, yeah. we're having fun, right? Yeah, totally. I mean, me and Adam are the only actors in them. Plus, we're the gaffer, the, you know, the cinematographer. So for any shot on him, I'm filming. For any shot on me, Adam's filming. It's like, we could rarely be in the same shot, and then we've got to kind of guess the focus mark. Of,
yes.
It was hard work kind of swapping it around. It was very much like, quick, chuck the camera over there, make sure we're not crossing the line, kind of everything. And
yeah. I don't know. We did that for a year. Like,
crazy, man. That's crazy. You did a short film every week for a year.
Pretty much. Like, I, at the time, I had a day job. I was working Monday to Friday. Friday, as soon as I finished work, I'd run into the car, zoom an hour and a half to Rich's, because I'm in London and Rich is in Oxford. I'd zoom up to his. I'd get here, have a coffee, have a cigarette at the time I smoked, and then we would just get straight to it. We would write and shoot the dialogue, and then we would spend the entire night. Sometimes after that, we'd spend the whole night shooting the film until maybe 5-6 in the morning. Then we'd come back, and Rich, because he's like, oh, I'm tired, but I kind of want to grade it. So Rich would start grading it and stuff. And then the next day we would either go and shoot more, like the rest of it, or it would be the whole day editing it. But most of the time it was like from Friday to Sunday, we were basically up the entire time, not sleeping and just getting it done, ready and uploaded, ready for the next Friday release. And some of the episodes, there's an episode where we go to hell and meet Shia.
Yes, Shia LaBeouf.
Yeah, and Rich.
I love that shit.
That was like super visual effects heavy and Rich, but like we spent the whole weekend shooting and doing
still did it in the weekend, which was like ridiculous.
But then it ate into your week. Rich had to do a load of stuff going into the week after that. Like,
right, it was genuinely clearly like it was too much for two people to handle. Like if you'd have had like an editor and you know a producer or like just even just a couple more people, I think you'd have probably like felt a bit saner, you know, through the process.
That's why I get like people like PewDiePie that they can afford to just they sit down in front of the camera, someone else shoots it, and then they walk away and they come back and the episode's uploaded for them, like and edited really well and stuff like that. It's like that would be the dream, wouldn't it? Recently to start doing deep fakes, and we were like,
yes, wanted to talk about that.
What are we doing?
What? Yeah, like what's the like? I just watched the Jack Black one, and I was like, "Oh my god, this is so fucked up."
we've taken a break from the channel for a bit, but there is
two more
that we've actually we could probably put them out or at least one out this week. There's a Vin Diesel one coming, and there's a Keanu Reeves one coming.
My god, they're so good though. Like the deep fake itself is like, it's better. I don't know if you guys saw The Mandalorian, but it's better than fucking Luke Skywalker.
I wouldn't say that. Because we can see all the flaws with it, but yeah, there's some dodgy, especially the first ones. We were using different techniques, and it took us a few weeks to learn. But because it takes 3 days to render, you don't want to just chuck it in the bin. So you're like, well, we'll
right.
Do you know what I mean? And we'll work and try and get better. So the first one was done with a technique that's easier on the graphics card. So that was
I just want to highlight like a thing that you just said and completely blew past. 3 days to render something. Like our listeners need to understand this. Like if you're going to get into visual effects, and you know, which is great because you can do right. You've got a laptop at home, Adobe After Effects, whatever it might be, and you can pull off something as awesome as the opening of Hosts, which is that shot coming out of the ground and the titles kind of flying past it, which I thought was just a great opening shot. I really really loved it.
That was an 11-hour render that time.
Really?
A GTX Titan graphics card. But the deepfakes are something else. That's not rendering, I guess. The deepfakes are machine learning. So it's the learning that takes like a week if you want to do it properly. We'd finish filming, we'd edit the episode, and then we'd film a deepfake, and then we'd set that up. It takes a couple of hours to set up. Get it learning, and then we'd leave it until Adam came back the week later, and then we'd go, how's it looking? Okay, let's try render out, and then it takes about an hour to render out, and then we go, it's pretty good, could probably do with a bit of this or maybe some tweaking in After Effects because there's some blemishes or something. And
I think the point is that you're doing something every time. You guys are coming back with a story on this stuff. This is like so good for our listeners because there are definitely two different types that listen to this. They're the ones that are like you that go out there and pick up the camera or pick up the VFX and you know they want to get into it, so it's like I'll try doing this, you know what I mean, because everyone thinks there's some magic to it and it's like, well, no, you just find out how to do it and then you do it to you.
Yeah, you learn how to do it. Teach yourself how to do it.
And sometimes, like you said, it takes 3 days to render something because that's how long it takes. But that's really, I think, important for listeners to hear that it's not a matter of getting it right every single time. It's learning how to get it right and coming back to it. Like, again, it's a pain in the ass to do a short film every week, but you guys did it. I'm sure when you came to do your feature, the fact that the two of you had worked together that much just blew it away. You know what I mean? You guys know your rhythms. It's the other reason that Ed and I always got the side projects going on, the other stuff that we come up with, because You know, you just have to keep working with things. And some things work and some don't. You know, my last side project that didn't work, I desperately, and I was noticing this from your website, I desperately wanted to make like a movie version of Final Fantasy VII Remake. Like in my head, it was like, I'm going to play this game, but I'm going to cut it so that it's just all the cool shots. And so it's like one continuous movie of you know, Cloud just kicking the crap out of everyone. Never happens because it literally, the first time I sat down to do this with the opening scene, that took me 3 days just to get 10 minutes done. And I was like, this isn't going to work. Like, this could take too long.
I think the key for a lot of people out there that want to be doing stuff and whatever, and I think the best advice I could give personally is like, oh, hold on, Rich has got something to show you.
Yes, you are a proper Final Fantasy geek, aren't you?
We made that in lockdown.
I've been playing. I just got a new OLED. Like it was, you know, my bonus came in from work, and I just got like a one of those OLEDs. Oh man,
screens,
I've been playing Final Fantasy VII Remake on it. It's just, oh, I want to kiss the
guys. Team. I'm on my fifth playthrough. Like,
nice, very nice.
Yeah. Very cool. That's one thing I'm proper geeky at is Final Fantasy VII. Love it.
Yeah,
the T-shirt, the sword, and
yeah. Absolutely, mate.
But yeah, keep cool. Busy. Like I said, just be creative. Like lockdown was killing me, so I was like, I'm gonna build the hard edge from Final Fantasy VII, and just went in the garage and made it. And I think it's like that. I'm trying to teach the kids the same thing because they want to get into filmmaking and stuff like that. So, I mean, I'm not great as in like. But I think it's the best way to learn is they'll say, I want to learn editing. So I'll just give them a laptop and open Premiere and go, then edit. And they'll be like, I don't know what to do. And I'll be like, well, that cuts, that does this, and this does that. Like, not even like showing them example, really. And they will figure it out and they will learn. I'll come back and they've started their own YouTube channel of just ripping ours off. And they're getting up to more subscribers.
So cute.
Already. Like, And they've done it by editing themselves and stuff, and they just letting them learn their own way. And I think that's how I learned. I, you know, got hold of a program and just either YouTube or just how to play with stuff and figured out how stuff works. And I think it's the best way to learn, kind of learn a way that works for you and get inspired by other things and go, I want to know how to do that. How would I do that? Well, this is how maybe I think you would do it, and do it like that. Just enjoy creativity.
Just do it. Shia LaBeouf. Just do it.
Just do it. All right, guys. Well, we're coming up to the end here. I just wanted, first of all, say thank you so much for your time. Like,
my God.
Infinitely helpful to our listeners and to us. Like,
thanks for having us, man. We really appreciate that.
Always the ending question. What's next? You guys were talking about a little bit, but what's in the cards for Dark Fables Media? Where are we coming next?
Well, as we mentioned before, we're in the midst of finishing up the story for our next film, which is an absolute roller coaster, I think.
Is this Dirge?
No, that's not.
Still on hold.
But there's this other one we spent the last few weeks really going into it and just pointing the story and realizing what sucks, taking that out, going back in. We're over halfway through, I reckon another couple of weeks and we'll be there, and then we will write the screenplay and then that's it. Then we'll be speaking to everyone we know and trying to reach those investors. And that's the
plan. Oh my God. Well, you know, if you guys need money, I can't help you. We can't really help you. But if you need hands on set, you know, like I think both of us would absolutely adore working with you guys,
of course.
You know, like I said before, I think your story and also like kind of how it's out there, like through your YouTube channel and stuff, is a fantastic one that more filmmakers need to get eyes on, and you know, hopefully we'll get you a little bump on subscriptions from some of our fans, because
yeah, we
definitely are worth watching.
Crazy promoters, it's just the way I am. I have to spam every network. And
we're gonna bug you on social media for a week at least.
We're really social people. I love just chatting, like It's like the other day. Have you seen Benny Loves You yet?
No, we might be doing that soon.
Watched it over the weekend, and we're gonna do a podcast on it because Carl, you know what I mean? He's already been like, "Can I come on and talk?" He's like, "Oh yeah, of course you can, mate." Like, yeah.
So like he messaged. I come on, I think he messaged and was like asking like, "What did you kind of do for promotion in the UK?" Because we came out first and kind of, you know, like you said, got to number three, and he was like, "Right, yeah," and we're on the same distributor in the UK as well. So he was like, "Oh, this," and I was like, "Just jump on a call, man, like, and we'll chat." We've chatted for like 4 hours straight. Like, I love talking to people, especially about what I'm passionate about. Do you know what I mean? Just want to share that passion. It's like, needs to overflow sometimes. It's like,
God.
You know, we've seen that, man, and that's really cool. Like, we've had. The community seems to be getting better and better for that. So I really appreciate you kind of adding to that because, you know, when I started this 3-4 years ago, it wasn't like that for me, at least. The people I was producing with were very kind of siloed. And I just don't think, like, it's UK, man. We have some of the best filmmakers, I think, in the world here, to be honest with you. But if we don't talk to each other, then how's it going to happen? You know what I mean? Like, can't get stuff together. So no, fully behind you on that, man. It's really cool.
I think there should be a new renaissance of some kind of UK, whether it horror or just like filmmakers in the UK kind of community and kind of building up and building that thing. Because a lot of it seems to be just the UK filmmakers tend to just be the backbone of the American film industry.
That's what always got me is you look at the numbers, because that's where I went first. When I started producing, obviously I went into the high level stuff and where's everything, and you look at the sheer amount of money that's being shipped back to Hollywood, and it's like, guys, why are you doing that? Like, certainly it's a great source of income, so don't shoot yourself in the foot. Like, definitely keep Hollywood here, but also take some for yourself. You know what I mean? I just thought, you know, I talked to Laurie about that for a while, talked to, you know, Mark Logan's another guy I've talked to about that before, is why isn't there more, you know, in the UK? Why don't we have a house or a studio here? And a lot of, you know, the answers I get are again, the siloed nature of things. No one wants to work with each other. I'm like, well, I'm not sure that's true. I just don't think people are trying. So, I mean, what you're doing, you know, it just helps so much to get everybody together and get us talking about things. And yeah, I think we are going to see, you know, if hosts and you were talking about Benny as well, if those are two examples, like we're on a really good track. You know what I mean? I think next couple of years are going to be great for the UK and the horror scene, and look forward to seeing the next one from you guys as well.
Yeah, man, so excited. And also, again, like, I can't believe how much, like, I'm geeking out that you guys came on here and talked to us.
This is geeking out. I love it.
We're all the same, man. We're all just geeks, just wanting to do what we do. You know what I mean?
Very much so.
There's no...
We will definitely be hitting, you know, unfortunately, once you get a hold of us, you can't not get a hold of us. So, you know, that's all you just had with Carl, like, expect me to be like, help! I've got this going on. I need to talk to somebody. Richard, Adam.
No, it's all good. Yeah, totally. We're always kind of open to advice and stuff. I had an email today from a kid kind of like, I've just got out of film school. Can I ask these questions on what you would do in these situations? So took time out of our writing and kind of was like to Adam, like, how would you answer this question? You know, composing these answers back, you know, I think it's important to kind of,
that's absolutely amazing, guys. I feel once again like super inspired, and I feel like we've made friends as well as, you know, getting to meet you know, some amazing filmmakers. So thank you so much, guys.
No problem. Do your project. Just get on with it.
We will.
Just do it.
All right, Joel, you all have a good rest of the night, guys. And yeah, we will catch you on the next one. As I said, we'll probably have you guys back again. So thank you so much.
For sure. Thank you, guys. All the best.
See you soon.
Bye. Bye-bye, guys. Bye. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye.